Very official. All right. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. I always say, like, I'm special ed background, so get up, do what you need to do, walk around, answer your phones. I am not very formal at all. A few disclaimers before we begin. I feel highly unqualified to give a class that's called a parenting class because I'm not an expert parent, and I know most of you in this room personally, and you know I'm not an expert parent, and we're all trying to figure it out. So the only reason I am qualified to speak on this topic is because I have training in collaborative problem solving that I'm going to tell you about, but I will tell you that every day it is a challenge and a test to be able to use this with my own kids and the kids that we work with. So please don't walk out of here with any expectations that CPS is the magic wand or that I do things perfectly. If you see my kids screaming in the grocery store in Jewel, just remember that I warned you that I am not perfect and that my kids aren't perfect. And with that being said, I think that having learned the collaborative problem-solving method and trying to use it at home, it has really significantly changed the way I parent and think about kids, especially when they're having a hard time, which is what we're going to be talking about tonight. So 2 points of Hakara Satov, one to Rachel for hosting. Thank you so much. And the other one to Rabbi Gershon Schaffel from Young Israel in Skokie. He took a personal interest in learning about collaborative problem solving and found out that I knew about it. And we started collaborating. And I told him I was actually trying to develop like a Torah perspective on collaborative problem solving. And he started to give me all these great sources. So much of the Torah content of what I'll present tonight is really attributed to his help, so I want to publicly thank him for that help. A little bit of background, I guess. I work with REACH, which I think most people know what REACH is. We're an organization that's affiliated with JUF, JCFS, which is Jewish Child and Family Services, and the ATT. And our mission is really to work with all the day schools, left to right, and everything in between to help promote inclusion and just better services for kids who don't fit in the box and just learn a little bit differently. So part of what we do is direct service programs in 3 schools and a lot of professional development for teachers, and that's really my role. I work primarily with teachers and administrators on the teaching end and trying to help them use more tools in the classrooms just to reach the needs of all the learners. And when I started with REACH 5 years ago, they were really invested in the collaborative problem-solving model. And so I just went through the whole training from A to Z, and that's really what I spend a lot of my time doing in the schools. There are 17 day schools, and I would say that we are heavily using CPS, teaching it to the teachers, training the staff in, I don't know exact numbers, but 12, 13 schools. So it's obviously something that the administrations are invested in. And now we're getting to the point where the teachers are saying, especially like at Beis Yaakov as an example, okay, we got it. We love it. We're using it with the students, but it would be so helpful if we got the parents on board so that they would know what this is all about and they could use it at home too. So now we're starting with parent groups in the schools, and God willing, there will be more to come. So as I started learning it, you know, I kept thinking about, there's so much Torah in this. Obviously, this is not a Jewish model at all. But I told myself a long-term goal would try to be to see how the theories of collaborative problem solving really intertwine and interact with Torah. So that was my, I guess, goal for this year and what I've started to put together. I guess just to do some plugging, there's 2 more parts, and we actually had to change some of the dates. So I'll certainly try to do each year as it's like standalone so that you don't feel like, well, you guys are all at the first one. So if you want to continue to come. But even with 3 shiurim, it's really going to be skimming the surface. So also another disclaimer is don't leave here and feel like you completely know what it is and how to do it. There's definitely great books to read, which I will recommend highly if you're interested in learning more. But hopefully tonight and the following will really just be to whet your appetites and kind of give you what to think about moving forward. So as we go through this, I think it's most helpful when we are in school, I tell teachers, think about a student. So I guess think about your own children and think about an expectation you have of them, something that they have a really hard time doing, or times when they have really challenging behavior. And I'm not talking about, you know, the one morning that it was really hard for them to get out of bed, and usually all the other mornings are good. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about if you have a kid for whom getting up in the morning is really, really hard, or the bedtime routine is really hard, or things in school are really hard, but consistently. That's kind of what I want you to be thinking about as we go through this. And if you don't have, if your children don't have consistent issues, then I think there's still parts of the philosophy that will speak to you, I hope. So if you have something in mind, when we think about why our kids don't follow through with something or why they misbehave, what are usually the reasons that we attribute to that? Like, why? Like when our kids are misbehaving?
Tired, hungry.
They're tired, they're hungry. And yes, they definitely could be tired and hungry. What else?
Trouble regulating.
They have spoken like a true teacher, right? They have trouble regulating. Regulating means like calming their bodies, calming themselves. What else? Or maybe I'll ask it differently. What are some of the things you hear teachers saying about why your child or why other children are misbehaving?
Attention.
They just want attention, right? They're trying to avoid something, or they're trying to get something. They want attention. They want to get out of doing something. They want to get a rise out of the other kids in the class, right? There's a lot of these reasons that are attributed to why kids misbehave. And if that's the case, if we say that kids do well if they want to, right? Also, another one you've probably heard, oh, they're just not motivated. They just don't care. I think especially when kids get older and it comes to, like, homework and stuff, like, he or she could do so much better if they just tried harder, if they just cared more. So there's a whole part of motivation that's tied up into this. So the conventional wisdom we say is that kids do well if they want to, right? Okay, so if kids do well if they want to and they're not doing well, how do we make them want to? What do we do? How do we typically react when a child misbehaves?
We bribe them.
We bribe them, yes, we bribe them, certainly. And sometimes it works. So we bribe, typically, rewards, right? Like the sticker charts, and punishments, right? If you don't finish your homework, or if you don't get out of bed in time, then you won't be able to have screen time later. Whatever it is, we use a lot of those contingency statements, right? The ifs and then the thens. Now, if that works, don't stop using it. I have a sticker chart at home for one of my children, and so far it's working, so I'm not going to feel guilty about the fact that I use it, despite the fact that we try to promote collaborative problem solving. If it works, then you should continue to use it, right? The question is, if it doesn't work. So on your source sheets, you have a picture. And if you can see it clearly, it's a picture of a path with two roads, right? And the idea is that the way we see a problem determines our solution to that problem. And we have two options, right? So if we say that kids do well if they want to, right? If kids do well because they're motivated and or they're not doing well because they want attention or whatever they is, then we're going to go down that road of rewards and punishment, right? And do they work? Sometimes, right? Yes, sometimes they work, and that's good. If they work, that's great. You've got it. Good. I always feel bad when I teach this because I feel like any teachers who use sticker charts are going to think that, like, we're saying you can't use them anymore. If they work, then that's great. But do they work for all of our kids all of the time? No, not really. And that's where collaborative problem solving comes in. How can we think of a different approach? So if we say that kids do well if they want to, and we try to get them to want to by motivating them with extrinsic motivations like rewards and sticker charts, that's one road that we can go down. Two ideas about kind of discipline from the Torah that I think really help shape where we're going with this are the following. If you see in the first source, it's a very famous pasuk from Sefer Mishlei, Choshech shivto soneh bno ve'ohavo shachro musar. That he who spares the rod hates the child, right? We've heard this in English too, like spare the rod, spoil the child. And he who loves him disciplines him early. So basically what it seems like, well, Shlomo is saying here, is that we shouldn't spare the rod, right? How, whatever that means in terms of whatever that punishment means. So how does the kind of that fit in? Should we be using harsh discipline to, you know, should we be using harsh discipline with our children? Should we be using punishment? Obviously, we all know that we shouldn't be using any types of physical abuse, but does punishment work? It says in Sefer Mishlei that if we don't punish, then we're spoiling the child. So I read a beautiful explanation, and I'm going to read it to you because I think it's better put this way than saying it, from a woman named Shalvi Waldman, who's an educator and therapist. It was an article about this pasuk on Chabad.org. And she says that a staff is solid and doesn't change. A staff is used for support on one's way, for parenting rules to successfully show our children that we are trying to build them in ways that are good for them. The rules must be solid and consistent. They must support the growth of the children on their paths and protect the needs of the parents. The staff is the measuring stick that the parent can use to show the child that there are realities, principles that obligate us all. So I thought that that was a really interesting metaphor for what a staff is. A staff is really kind of a measurement stick of what our rules and expectations are for children. She goes on to say, adults who have solid principles that support them in all their ways will be able to measure the behavior of their children in a predictable and safe way and respond to inappropriate behavior in ways that don't undermine their parental authority or just blow off anger. They will be able to feel the support and love within themselves and be able to support and love their children. One who loves his child disciplines him in his youth. If you love your child, you will help him to develop himself in a disciplined way in his youth, before things get out of hand. You will make time to explain to your child, not in the heat of anger, but in a moment of warmth and understanding, why you expect him to behave in a particular way and why that is important to you and ultimately to him. So what this is really showing us, I think, is the importance of consistency in what our rules and expectations are for our children. That whatever those rules and expectations are, and they look different in every home, they also look different in every classroom, which, by the way, sometimes you have a kid who's doing amazing in one class and terrible in another class, and the teachers are like, I don't get it. Why is it just my class? And so then we have to explain to them. It's really hard for kids. You have to navigate a whole different system of expectations in different classrooms. And the older they get, the more classrooms they have, it makes it that much more challenging. So it just speaks to the importance of consistency of rules and expectations, especially in our own homes, where that is just one solid environment. And that those rules and expectations need to be fitting for who our children are, and that we really need to know who they are. And that is a very, very solid foundational approach of collaborative problem solving, and we'll talk about it more. But it's that the expectations that we have for our children need to meet them where their skill set are. So I'll give you an example. I remember this so clearly when my oldest two were like 3 and 4 and a half. I said to them, like, after bedtime, you know, it's time to go upstairs, put on pajamas, brush teeth, and get in bed, okay? So 4 and a half-year-old Shayna, at the time, she could follow those multiple directions and do everything I said and get in bed. And 3-year-old Ellie would be, like, hanging out in the bathroom, like, playing with the water after he brushed his teeth. And I could have thought to myself, well, he's just, like, not following my rules. Like, why isn't he doing what I'm asking him to do? But very simply, I had an expectation for him that wasn't developmentally appropriate because he couldn't follow my multi-step directions at that age. So we have to, of course we have rules in our house and they're the same for everybody, but we have to make sure that our rules and our expectations for our children meet them developmentally where they are and where their skill sets are. We're going to talk a little bit about skills later. So that's kind of one fundamental idea that will stick through as we grow through this, the idea that expectations need to meet skills. Another definition of discipline that I heard that I thought was really beautiful comes from Rav Pam. Rav Pam was a Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vedat in Brooklyn in the 20th century, a well-known Rav, and he gave a mashal. And he said that if you have a dirty metal pot and you go to wash it with boiling water, what happens to the pot? Gets clean, right? You wash a metal pot like we all do with hot water and you get it clean. What happens if you have a pottery vessel? If you have a pottery vessel that's dirty and you try to wash it with boiling hot water, what happens to that pottery vessel? It crumbles and it breaks, right? And he says that the boiling water is a nimshal for the harsh discipline, like when we really try to discipline our kids in a very, very harsh way. And of course, the pottery vessel is our children, right? And when we use very, very harsh discipline on them, whatever your definition of harsh discipline is, we see that they crumble. I'm guessing, okay, maybe not you, but me. I've lost my patience with my kids before, and I've yelled at them, and I've got upset with them, and that's been the harsher side of my disciplining. And it didn't really get us very far. One of us ended up crying in the end, right? And we're only human, and sometimes that happens. But the idea is that that harsher kind of discipline isn't necessarily going to change things long term, right? It might have scared our kids enough to get them to not do whatever they did the next day or the next week, but long term, it's not going to make any significant differences. And feel free to argue or tell me that I'm wrong. It's just my experience and kind of what the philosophy says. So, again, this idea from Rav Palm of recognizing who our children are and finding disciplinary approaches that are compatible with what their personalities are. So obviously a lot of this is about knowing who our kids are and knowing them really well, which hopefully as parents we do, but sometimes that's also hard to figure out, like, different approaches for different kids and what they need. So we said that sometimes this extrinsic motivation works, and if you look at the research behind extrinsic motivators like rewards and punishments, if any of you are familiar with like ABA, applied behavioral analysis, says something we do with kids who struggle significantly with behaviors, kids on the autistic spectrum, it's a way that we teach behavior. Extrinsic rewards were really meant to teach basic lessons, but they are not meant to build skill. And a lot of times in classrooms especially or at home, we try sticker chart after sticker chart or reward system or after reward system, and we expect change. And like I said, we see it short term, but generally speaking, for whatever the issue is that we're dealing with, we don't necessarily see that long-term change when it comes to those kinds of extrinsic rewards. Even the things getting taken away or the things getting grounded, whatever that kind of thing that you're taking away, it certainly works and the kids are certainly upset and they learn their lesson, but it doesn't necessarily mean that long-term things are changing, and I would argue that it doesn't necessarily mean that you're helping to strengthen the relationship between you and your child when you do things that way. So all of this is to talk about, if that's the conventional approach, kids do well if they want to, rewards and punishment, CPS is taking a different approach. And the tagline behind CPS, collaborative problem solving, is that kids do well if they can. So it sounds very simple, but let it sink in for a minute. Kids do well if they can. So what does that mean, that kids do well if they can? There's an underlying assumption there, and that is that everybody wants to do well. And again, this is one of those times when I heard everybody wants to do well. I'm like, there has to be Torah about that for sure, absolutely. So if you look at source number two, another source in Sefer Mishlei, HaMelech Shlomo says, Lev yodea maras nafsho uvesimchaso lo yisarev zar, that the heart alone knows its bitterness and no outsider can share in its joy. And this goes back a minute to this idea of kids do well if they want to. We make so many assumptions about why children are misbehaving without necessarily knowing what it is, right? And the heart alone knows what ails him. And sometimes we certainly try to speak to our children to find out what is bothering them, what's at the core of whatever it is that's happening. But a lot of times we make assumptions about that. And I think especially maybe teachers who don't know our kids as well as we know our own children or know them in a different way, jump to conclusions about why our children are behaving in certain ways. And that can be really difficult. And sometimes we're looking for an easy explanation for behavior because we wish we had an easy explanation. But it's really the child himself who knows what's driving him. And it's up to us as the adults, as the parents, as the helpers, to try to figure out what that is. So if kids do well if they can, not if kids do well if they want to, if kids do well if they can, then what we say is that challenging behavior happens when a child is presented with a situation or with an expectation that he doesn't have the thinking skills to be able to handle. I'm going to hand this out to you guys now so that when I keep talking about skills, you'll have an idea of what I'm talking about. You'll see Think Kids on here. Think Kids is the organization that really created collaborative problem solving. And these are five areas of research-based thinking skills. And as we go through, you can look at them and think about your own children and think about what are the skills that they have really well solidified and what are the skills that they're still developing. Now, when a child lacks a skill to do something, there could be for two reasons. One is simply developmentally, right? A five-year-old does not have the same skill set as a 10-year-old because they haven't matured to that extent. And other times is they can't access those skills in a certain situation. So when a child is misbehaving, and going back to that example of that chronic misbehavior, what are the skills that we're asking them to use in those situations that they don't have yet or that they can't meet? So let's take a common home example. I keep going back to morning, like getting up in the morning. That could be really hard for some kids, or just following through with getting out of bed, or maybe it's doing homework at night, whatever it is. We have certain expectations of them, and we think of the kids who have a really hard time meeting those expectations. transitioning. It's hard at school. It's also hard at home. Like, okay, it's time to turn off the iPad, or it's time for lights out. It's time to sit down and do your homework. Whatever it is, transitions can be hard. The kids who have a hard time with it on a consistent basis, we have to look at this and say to ourselves, what am I asking them to do? What skills am I expecting them to have or be able to use that maybe they don't have or maybe aren't well developed yet? So this is kind of that sheet of those five areas of lagging skills. But going back to the idea of kids do well if they can, the underlying assumption is that everybody wants to do well. Everybody runs to do good. And Rav Noach Orlowick, he wrote three well-known books about parenting, and he's a very well-known author and lecturer in Israel. One of his books is called Raising Roses Among Thorns. And he talks a lot in that book about just raising kids in society today. And he says that same exact thing. Every child is inherently good. And he says that misconduct, I guess a fancy word for misbehavior, must be considered a technical matter, not as something that reflects the person as a whole. The essence of a person is immutably good. And he quotes, Elokai neshama shenatata bi tahorahi. Every morning we wake up and we say, Hashem, the nefesh that you gave me is pure because you gave it to me, right? If we're all created b'tzelem Elokim, then we all want to be, do good. We all want to be as godly-like as possible. It's in each of us, right? So it's not that we want to be bad, and if a kid misbehaves, it's because he's a bad kid. Inherently, we're all good. It's just that sometimes we don't have the skills. And I can make it very relatable to all of us. I do this with teachers sometimes. I say, how many of us procrastinate before we have a big assignment due or something kind of big that we have to do? Or how many of us get very flustered when we have to speak in public? Or how many of us, and this is me, get very frustrated when you're in line at the grocery store and the person in front of you needs to have like five different items price checked and you just start to get very agitated? We all, even as well-developed, skilled adults, have situations in which, if we could, we would act better, right? But sometimes we have lagging skills or skills that we can't access in the moment, so we get agitated. Or how about the example I gave before? Sometimes we lose it with our own kids, right? We wished that we didn't act that way in that situation, but in the moment, we can't. Does that mean we're bad people? Of course not. It means that in the moment we had a hard time accessing the skills that we needed to do a really good job. So if we as adults are like that, then obviously we can understand where it's coming from for our children. There's a source in Kohelis, number 3, that says, "Ki adam in tzadik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov velo yachteh." There is not one good man on earth who does what is best and doesn't err. Everybody does wrong. Once in a while, we all mess up, but it doesn't mean that we don't want to be good. A lot of the Torah wisdom that I got related to collaborative problem solving came from a book called Netivei Chinuch by the Nisivos Shalom, if you've heard of him. He was the Slonim Rebbe, Rav Shalom Noach Berezovsky, and he was really considered one of the most influential of the contemporary Hasidic Rebbes among Hasidim and non-Hasidim alike. He wrote many commentaries on Parsha, but he has a specific book called Netivei Chinuch, which is all about education. And he writes that you have to have full confidence in the child. You have to believe that he can be good and be committed to doing whatever it will take to help him be successful. We shouldn't push kids away. We can maybe get them to comply with harsh discipline, but we can't really teach them long term. If we think of the word discipline, typically, what do we think when we think, what do you think discipline means?
Punishing.
Usually we think of it as like punishing. Anyone know what the actual definition of discipline is? What's the word disciple? A disciple is somebody, a student, someone you teach. To discipline is actually to teach. And I'm sorry I keep drawing it back to teachers. That's just where we do most of this work. But I have this slide that I show teachers, and I say if a kid doesn't know how to read, we teach them. If a kid doesn't learn how to do math, we teach them, we teach. And then I say if a kid doesn't learn how to behave, we... And then I get all the responses. We punish, we reward, we talk to their parents, right? Like all the different things we do, as opposed to we teach them. We teach them how to behave. And the beauty of collaborative problem solving, which we won't get to this part tonight, is that there's actually a whole methodology for how we help kids learn how to behave by helping them build the skills that they don't have. So we teach them. Discipline is about teaching them. And doing it in a harsh way, like we said before, isn't necessarily going to teach them. It might scare them, but it's not necessarily going to teach them. Another source that just goes along to show that it's really about everybody wanting to do well. This comes from Yeshayahu, number 4. Ve'amcha kulam tzadikim. Right? Everybody is a tzaddik. Everybody wants to do well. This is a chazal that Rabbi Shaffel gave to me. He says that what gets in the way of everybody wanting to do well, of everybody wanting to do the Ratzon Hashem, is the Or Sheba Isa, which is a metaphor for the Yetzer Hara. If a person isn't behaving well, if a person isn't behaving like a tzaddik, then there's an impediment that isn't allowing the individual to express his essential part of his neshama. And the question is, what's getting in the way? What's not allowing him to move forward? So Chazal clearly, or I should say that collaborative problem solving clearly lines up with what Chazal speak about when they say that if a person isn't doing well, then there's something that's getting in their way, right? And we see that with our kids, I think, I hope. When they're having such a hard time, like, it's hard to believe that they want to be having such a hard time. It's hard to believe that they want to be having that tantrum. I mean, maybe not always. Maybe sometimes we think they're just trying to drive us crazy, and they're accomplishing that very well. But when it happens continuously, or when it happens over and over, or if it doesn't happen at home, but if it happens at school, it's really hard to believe that they want that to be happening. It's hard to believe that they want to be getting in trouble and going to the principal's office or being called out by the teacher. You know, of course, there's always exceptions to the rule. And, you know, maybe this speaks to me because it's just naturally what I believe, and there's people who don't, and that's fine. We can totally disagree. But it's hard for me to believe that kids want to be in situations where they know that they've done something wrong or that they've disappointed someone or that they're different than their friends. So we really have to think about what is it that's getting in their way if they're not doing well. And when we don't see our kids complying with our expectations, then there's two things we need to ask ourselves. Number one, going back to what we said before, what is it that I'm asking my child to do that he or she is having a hard time doing? It's identifying those triggers. Like, what are the triggers? And I always say that, like, for example, in the classroom, if you know you're about to do something and you hesitate to say it or to do it because you know, oh, when I do this or say this, it's going to make Johnny fly off the wall. And I think that we have those same things at home. Like, oh my gosh, I know that when I tell them that, you know, tomorrow afternoon we are going to grandma's house, I don't know, I know that this child is going to have a really hard time with it. We have those situations where we pause before something because we can predict that one of our kids is going to have a meltdown or is going to freak out or is going to shut down or whatever it is. Those are good indications that those are what we call the triggers. So one thing to think about is, what are the triggers? What are the situations in which my child is having a really hard time? And once you can identify what the triggers are, then you can better think to yourself, okay, well, what are the skills that this expectation is calling upon them to use that they're having a hard time accessing? Bless you. And I didn't bring the paperwork because this isn't a class, but when we formally go through the process of using collaborative problem solving, there's a form we used, called an APT, the Assessment and Planning Tool, and there's 3 categories. So in the first category, we list all the challenging behaviors. What is my child doing, or what is the student doing that's really challenging, right? And we do that first. And that we put aside, because what we're not doing with collaborative problem solving is we're not trying to solve behavior. And when I say that, people are like, what do you mean? The whole point of being here is that we want to get rid of these bad behaviors. 100%, we want to get rid of the behaviors. But saying to a child, you can't hit anymore, and if you don't hit, then you'll get a sticker, and if you do hit, then you'll go to the principal's office, fine, that's fine and dandy. But what's making them want to hit in the first place, or what's making them hit in the first place? We have to take one step back and figure out what's causing the behavior in the first case. What are those situations? What are those expectations we have that they're not able to meet? What are the triggers? So that's why we take that step back, and then we make a list of what are the skills, what are the lagging skills, what are the skills that we feel like our child has not developed or is expected to use that he or she isn't able to use in that situation. So when we think about, so there are two taglines we use in collaborative problem solving. One is kids do well if they can, and the other one is that it's about skill, not will, right? We said before that if a child isn't able to do well, over and over, not talking about the one-time situations. It's not that they don't have the will, the motivation, in Hebrew, the ratzon, to do well. They want to do well, but they don't have the skills, or they can't access the skills for whatever reason it is. So if we focus on skills, if we go down the path, we have the two paths. If we say it's not that kids do well if they want to, but it's that kids do well if they can, if it's about the skill and not the will, how does that kind of shift our approach to the situation? How does that shift our reaction to behaviors? If you see your kid melting down and it's always sitting around the table and our kids aren't here and kids do well if they can, yeah, that makes sense. It's so nice. But next time your kid is having a meltdown and you try to remember kids do well if they can, it's really, really hard. Assuming you can remember it in that situation, how does that even shift your thinking about what your reaction might be to the situation when you say, okay, they're having a hard time. If she could, she would do well right now, right? And we don't always remember it. And like I said at the beginning, it's really, really hard to do. But that's what we kind of try to shift our mind towards. Why is he or she having such a hard time right now? What am I asking them to do that they can't do? And how can we make this better? And the whole how can we make this better is parts 2 and 3. But today we're really focusing on thinking about the philosophy. So when we think about the skill, we think that, and this, don't get scared when I say this, it helps teachers a lot, and I think you can understand the comparison, is that when a child has a learning disability, right, if we say that a child has a diagnosed reading disability, then we would hope or expect that the teacher would change their expectations for what it is that the child needs to learn, or how quickly they pick up the skills, or even how they're teaching them. You teach them in smaller increments, you slow down the pace. You have different expectations for how far the kid would get. When a child has a chronic behavior issue, or a behavior issue kind of that is pervasive and is not a one-time thing, we almost have to look at it like a learning disability, in the sense that, excuse me, we have to modify what our expectations are for that child, because just like they don't have the reading skills to meet a certain expectation, in some cases, children don't have the thinking skills to meet a certain expectation. And also it helps us understand when we look at skills and say, okay, so my child really has a hard time seeking attention in appropriate ways. That gives us something to work with, right? And we can think about how do we help our child learn how to seek attention in appropriate ways, as opposed to, I don't know what's making them triggered all the time. I don't know why they're having these tantrums and flying off the wall and kind of not having anything to work with. So when we focus on skills, it really helps direct our attention and helps us, helps guide us in terms of how to work with the child. And of course, not all challenging behavior arises from lagging skills. Of course, there are moments when our children are just, well, the social worker that we work with taught us this, and I use it all the time. HALT, I don't know if anyone has heard this before, is your child hungry, angry, lonely, or tired? And sometimes challenging behavior is just because of one of those things. And I see that with my kids a lot. Sometimes it's just that they're hungry, they're angry about something, lonely in the sense that like they're feeling misunderstood, or they're tired, right? And sometimes challenging behavior is no more than that, and we don't have to go digging for what skills don't they have right now. They're just being a kid, because that happens. Again, we're talking about the situations that are common and that you see over and over again. And what happens, what's the danger in taking a kid who has a skill deficit and saying, oh, they're just doing this out of willfulness, excuse me. They're just doing this because they're not motivated or because they're being stubborn. When we approach it that way, then it becomes like we're kind of getting into battles with our kids, and we become angry, and they become angry. There's two catchy phrases that I like to remember, and one is that calm is contagious. When we stay calm, then it generally is contagious, in the sense that that helps de-escalate an escalated situation. I mean, we know when we get escalated, when we get escalated as the parents, it doesn't necessarily help de-escalate our children. So that when we can de-escalate, it generally helps them calm down. So calm is contagious. And the second one is to be curious and not furious, right? It's so easy to just be upset and angry and frustrated all the time. But instead, like we said, to approach misbehavior and to approach our challenging children with curiosity. Like, what is it that's eating at them? What is it that's getting it in? Why are they having such a hard time? Those are two really, I think, good lines to remember in the heat of things. And the Netive Chinuch, quotes the Baal Shem Tov, whose cardinal rule is the following: Nothing created by Hashem is truly evil. All of man's seemingly evil character traits really at the root emanate from the source of good and have the positive role to play. It is the job of the educator or mentor to study the character makeup of the child in depth and provide direction accordingly. So what Torah, I think, is asking of us, and what CPS is certainly asking of us, is to try to really figure out our kids and figure out what triggers them, what motivates them, what really gets to them. And this is all part of what he says, Al Pi Darko. And this is a source that you've probably heard many times before in Sefer Mishlei. It's source number 5. You don't have to look at it. Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko, that we need to train our children, we need to educate the children, Al Pi Darko, according to their ways, according to what's good for them. Gam Ki Yaskin Lo Yasur Mimana, so that when they're older, right, they will not stray from it. We need to teach them in a way that's befitting of their personalities, of their skill sets when they're younger. So whatever education we're trying to inculcate in our children as parents, whatever morals we try to give over to our children, we have to teach them in a way that's befitting them when they're young, so that when they're older, it will always stick with them. And you think so much about, I think so much about, the kids who have gone off the derech, or kids who have really strayed from their families religiously or not, and how were they taught? I always wonder, as kids that have kind of made them stray. And I think a lot about the educational system and when kids' needs aren't being met, or when they're in, you know, certain environments where they're expected to be a certain way or look a certain way or learn a certain way, and they don't fit that box. We see so often that they fray because they're not taught in a way that works for them. That is a topic I feel I could talk about for a very long time, but it's all about for all of our schools and for us as parents to figure out what works for each of our kids. And it's a tall order. It's hard, you know, especially in school where you have so many kids and so many different styles. But as parents in our homes, we even see that with our own children, that every child is different, right? Every kid has what works for him or her. The question is, how do we figure out how to reach them in a way that's meaningful to them? And the Ralbag, the last source that we'll go through for the night, talks about this idea of chanuch lanar, of educating a child. And he says, asher yachnuch lanar al pi haderech asher min hago v'tivo lalechet ba, that we have to educate our children in the way that is natural to them, is the natural path for them. We already have to be thinking about, when they're kids, how is what I'm teaching them now going to, how am I going to take what I want them to learn now and teach it to them a way that is going to stick with them when they're older? We're so, I think especially when we have young kids, we're so caught up in the here and now of just getting through every day alive and well and getting them to sleep at night. But thinking kind of long term about how are the values that are really important to me, that I want to me, my husband, to our family, that we want to give over to our children, how do I teach it to them in a way now, even when they're little, so that it will stick with them when they're older? And hopefully we can all think back to the way our parents raised us and have hopefully good memories of lessons that they tried to teach us, that even if we realize that the time weren't lessons, are things that have stuck with us because they said, in our family, this is what we do. Whatever it was, how did our parents teach us things in a meaningful way when we were younger that stuck with us when we were older? And the rest is talking about the fact that we hope that we teach it in a way to them that it sticks and that they won't stray from it, gamba et ziknato, when they're older. So that's the Ralbag, and that's really what collaborative problem solving is. It's just the philosophy, it's just the tip of the iceberg, but it's thinking about our children, their unique makeups, their skill sets, and how we teach them in a way that's meaningful. So just kind of review, one is kids do well if they can, right? That we're all created B'Tselem Elohim, that everyone is inherently good. It's the philosophy of collaborative problem solving, rooted in Torah for sure. Skill, not will. Right? That it's not a matter of willfulness and children trying to get a rise out of us. At times, yes, but if we see it a lot, then it's more about the skills. what are our expectations and how do they match where our kids are currently. And the idea of discipline, right? Knowing our children and that harsh discipline doesn't work and that we want to teach them in a softer way. Coming up, moving forward, if you're able to join us, great. If not, don't worry. But we talked a lot about what the philosophy is. I think everyone gets it. So the question is, okay, then what's next? Like, what if my child is lagging skills and sticker charts aren't the best answer? So how do I approach them? So one thing we're going to talk a lot about is how do we help children build intrinsic motivation? How do we help them be motivated to meet expectations because they want to do it, right, on their own, not because of the Slurpee they're going to get on Friday or the 5 tickets they're going to get from Rebbe or because they know that they can't go to the basketball game if they don't? How do we move away from extrinsic motivation towards intrinsic motivation? So we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to talk about a core part of collaborative problem solving, which is the collaborative part, and how to talk to our kids and how to elicit that information and get them to be partners with us in figuring out what the issues are, what's triggering them, and actually how we move forward in coming up with solutions that work for them. So that's to come. But you don't have to come to the shiurim because I'm going to recommend two books. I mean, you should come. You should definitely come if you can. I'm very bad at self-promotion. You should come because it's a good topic to learn about. But if you can't and if you're interested in learning more, there are two doctors who created the model, Dr. Ross Green and Dr. Stuart Ablon, and the joke is that they didn't know how to collaboratively problem solve because they actually split up. But Dr. Ross Green wrote a book called Lost at School, and that is the book that we really use with teachers because it's really specifically about collaborative problem solving in the school setting. But it's a very, very good book. And Dr. Ablon wrote his own book, of course. And his book is called Changeable, Changeable, Changeable. And he talks about collaborative problem solving in every setting. So each chapter is about how you can use this model and this philosophy in different settings. So he talks about school, workplace, relationships. He talks about jail systems and things like that. And it's funny because I've obviously been learning this for a while, and I didn't tell my husband to read Lost at School, but when Changeable came out, I'm like, you have to read this. And then he read it, he's like, now I know what you do to me when you talk to me in this way. I'm like, yeah, my secret's out. But it's a really good book, and the point being that I think it's anybody would appreciate it. So those are two really good books to read, and there's tons of other resources. And if you want any more information, I would be happy to share. But I hope that gives you a little bit of a sense of what the philosophy is, and we will continue to learn together. So thank you. And I've never spoken this long about this without interaction. So does anybody have any thoughts or questions? When I do this with teachers, there's at least three teachers who like push back a lot. So I'm really used to it. So if you want to push back, you can, or if you have any specific questions, or if you don't have questions and want to go home because it's late, that's also fine too.
So you're training them now in the day schools. Are they implementing it as well?
It's a really good question. So they say that implementation, to do it well and with fidelity, takes 3 to 5 years, which sounds like a long time, but it's really a mindset shift. Like, especially for teachers who have been teaching for a long time, it's really a mindset shift. The schools that I see it working best in are the ones where the administration is really bought in and on board and really motivating teachers to use it and saying, this is how we do it. So we have one school we work with that, like, this has become their protocol and their model for how they deal with discipline throughout, which is, that's where it works the best, obviously. And then other schools, a lot of schools we have where, like, teachers have gone through the training and they themselves are super inspired by it and they implement it in their own Dalet Amos, but it's not like a school-wide thing. It looks different in different schools and even within a school in different classrooms. But yeah, I always say, like, I hope it becomes contagious, and like, and that, and it does happen sometimes that a teacher will be using it and another teacher will be like, what are you doing? Like, this kid is terrible in my class. How do you get in? And she's like, well, collaborative problem solving. And then that's kind of how more teachers catch on. So yeah, we still have a long ways to go. I'm not pretending that we're like perfect at all. But I think the reason it's caught on is because people need something different, because the typical kids do well if they want to, we see that it doesn't really work with our kids anymore.
Right.
It does for some. And when we talk about this, we're really not talking about 80% of the kids who can follow expectations and can meet, you know, follow the rules. It's for the kids who have a much harder time. But I hope you see that even if you don't have a child at home who has significant behavior issues, even the philosophy of those moments when they are having a meltdown to be able to think about and frame behavior this way as opposed to they're just trying to drive me crazy, you know. It helps. Yeah. Thank you guys for coming out.
I'm just curious, like, my own kid, he's 10. Like, how do you teach a kid to deal with disappointment? Like, when does that skill, like, age appropriate? I mean, I think by 10 it should be, but I'm just saying, like...
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know, like, what... Is anyone here a psychologist? I don't know what age it's supposed to be. I think that 10 is a proper age for them to be able to begin to deal with disappointment. Mm-hmm. But what about when they can't? You know, and that's a great example of identifying a trigger when he will be faced with disappointment, right? And that's even a lagging skill, like something that he doesn't have the ability to do with. And then you get into the conversation part with him, talking about what's hard for him when it comes to dealing with disappointment. And the whole idea, I'm like going 100 years ahead, is that you're helping him build the skills and identify what's hard for him and trying to incrementally help him be able to use that skill in a more productive way, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
But that's like, I'm jumping ahead. Training, when you go through training, just the first year of training for this, it's 16 hours. So I'm trying to like give you little tidbits. There's so much more. But the books are really, really good. I think they give a lot of information. All right, thank you guys. Thank you all for coming. Let me pause this.
Great.